Welcome to A Catra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Catra AI. So today we're embarking on a deep dive, really getting into one of the most, well, chillingly prophetic and enduring works of contemporary literature, Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale.
That's right. And our mission really is to navigate its stark, dystopian vision, explore the profound journeys of its characters, and sort of unearth the timeless messages it still holds for us today.
Margaret Atwood herself, she's such a towering figure in Canadian literature, isn't she?
Oh, absolutely. Her work, novels, poetry, it consistently delves into these really critical themes: power, identity, environmental decay, gender dynamics, you name it.
And she famously preferred speculative fiction over science fiction for this book, right?
Exactly. Because of that quote, which just hits so hard, I didn't put in anything that we haven't already done, we're not already doing, or we're not technically capable of doing.
Chilling.
It really is. That prescience is what makes it so unsettlingly powerful, even, you know, decades later.
Okay, let's really unpack this then, because it's fascinating just how prescient she turned out to be. Why do you think her observations from way back in 1985 feel so unnervingly relevant now?
Well, that's a huge question. I mean, the book itself came out in 85, right in the middle of this conservative resurgence, the Reagan era, the rise of the religious right.
A time when feminist gains felt pretty threatened.
Precisely. And its initial reception was overwhelmingly positive. It won the Arthur C. Clarke Award, got nominated for the Booker. But its cultural weight has just exploded since then.
Yeah.
It definitely stands alongside giants like 1984 or Brave New World, but it carves out its own unique space with that laser focus on reproductive rights and female agency.
And the symbols, they've just transcended the page.
Totally. Those red cloaks and white wings. Mm. You see them at protests, demonstrations. They become this visceral living symbol. It's quite extraordinary.
It really is. Almost like a universal shorthand for resistance now. So, okay, for anyone listening who maybe hasn't stepped into this world Atwood created, let's set the scene.
Right. So picture this. Near future New England. There's been some kind of environmental catastrophe and a devastating fertility crisis.
And the U.S. government is gone.
Gone. Replaced by the Republic of Gilead. It's a totalitarian, Christian fundamentalist theocracy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a society where women are stripped of basically every right.
No property, no jobs, can't read.
Can't control their own bodies.
Yeah.
Nothing. It's a rigid caste system.
And central to that system are the handmaids.
The handmaids. That's the terrifying core premise. They're the few remaining fertile women forced into sexual servitude to bear children for the ruling elite, the commanders, and their infertile wives.
Justified by twisting Bible passages, right?
Yeah, chillingly justified by selectively interpreting the story of Rachel and Bilhah. It turns the most intimate human experiences into instruments of state control. The personal becomes brutally political.
And it's through the eyes of our protagonist, Offred, that we see this world. Her name even tells you.
Exactly.
Oh.
Offred. She belongs to Commander Fred. It's not a name. It's a marker of ownership.
Her life is just this cycle of fear and routine punctuated by the ceremony. Can you maybe describe that a bit?
Yeah. It's this monthly ritual. Completely dehumanizing, ritualized sex, I suppose you'd call it, but designed solely for procreation. There's no connection, no consent. It's clinical and awful.
So the core struggle really becomes Offred's internal battle, doesn't it? How does she hold on to herself, her real name, June, her husband, Luke, her daughter, Hannah, when the whole system is designed to erase her?
Absolutely. It's a profound psychological battle, mostly fought inside her own head.
Mm.
And her world is populated by these characters who really illuminate Gilead's oppression in different ways.
Like the commander himself.
Commander Fred Waterford, yeah. His motives are disturbingly ambiguous. Then there's Serena Joy, his wife, bitter, complex.
She used to be an advocate for traditional values, ironically.
Precisely. And now she's trapped by the system she helped build. Then you have the Marthas, the household servants, Ofglin, her shopping partner, who turns out to be more than she seems.
And the aunts.
And the brutal aunts, yes. The enforcers, the indoctrinators at the Red Center where handmaids are trained. Every interaction Offred has is just dripping with suspicion, unspoken rules, and the threat of violence.
These aren't just side characters, though. They all have their own complex paths. Let's start with Offred. You said she starts numb, retreating into memory, but she does change slowly.
She does. It's a slow burn, her internal journey, from passive survival to gradually finding the willingness to take these incredible risks. What's fascinating is how she reclaims tiny, almost invisible bits of agency.
Tiny acts of rebellion.
Exactly. Then you have Moira, her friend from college.
Moira's the opposite, almost. Total defiance early on.
Right, a real force. Her escape from the Red Center is legendary, a symbol of hope, but her eventual fate at Jezzel's.
Well, that's heartbreaking.
It really is. It shows the limits, the crushing costs of that kind of overt resistance. Even the strongest can be broken.
And Nick, the chauffeur, he's such an enigma.
Completely. Is he an eye, one of Gilead's spies? Is he Mayday, part of the resistance? Their relationship, so forbidden and intimate, becomes this source of dangerous hope for Offred. Very dangerous. And speaking of contradictions, let's look at Commander Fred Waterford. He's an architect of Gilead, high-ranking, yet he seems lonely, disillusioned almost.
Those secret Scrabble games?
Right. A total violation of the rules. It shows his own need for connection, for intellectual stimulation, things his own society denies him, denies everyone. It really speaks to the corrupting nature of power, but also how it diminishes everyone, even the powerful.
And Serena Joy is just as complex, maybe even more tragic in a way.
I think so. Once his televangelist pushing for the very values that created Gilead, now she's trapped. No public voice, stuck in this domestic sphere that only brings her bitterness because she can't have a child.
Which fuels her cruelty towards Offred.
Terribly so. Her journey is a perfect illustration of that chilling line from the book, "Better never means better for everyone."
So true. And we have to talk about Ofglin.
Yes, Ofglin. Her initial appearance is so pious, so by the book. So when she reveals she's part of Mayday.
It's a huge shock and a spark of hope for Offred.
A dangerous spark.
Yeah.
And if you connect it to the bigger picture, Ofglin's arc is short but brutal. Choosing suicide over being tortured to protect the resistance.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a stark reminder of the stakes. Incredibly high stakes.
Atwood tells Offred's story in fragments, jumping between the present and past. It really reflects her state of mind, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You're plunged into that oppressive present. The silent shopping trips, the tense meals, dreading the ceremony.
But then you flash back.
Yeah, these vivid memories surface.
Mm-hmm.
Life before Gilead Luke, Hannah, her job, and then the slow, terrifying takeover. Constitution suspended, women fired, bank accounts frozen.
Their failed escape attempt.
That slow creep is what's so terrifying. How easily freedom can just evaporate.
But then, as she's trapped, cracks start to appear in the system, right? The commander's secret meetings.
Yeah, the Scrabble games offering her forbidden books. It's a violation, sure, but it's also this flicker of forbidden humanity, intellectual connection.
And then Serena Joy's plan.
Which is born out of sheer desperation. Arranging for Offred to sleep with Nick because she thinks the commander is sterile. It pushes Offred into this whole new territory of danger and, well, forbidden desire.
And that desire turns into something real with Nick.
It does. Their affair in that little room over the garage becomes this huge act of rebellion against the state controlling her body. It's passionate. It's genuine.
At the same time, Ofglin tells her about Mayday.
Giving her that flicker of hope that she's not alone. There's a resistance. But things get complicated fast. The commander takes her to Jezebel's.
The secret brothel. Here. Exposing all the hypocrisy.
Utter hypocrisy. And that's where she sees Moira again. Now, a prostitute, seemingly resigned, it's just devastating for Offred, makes escape feel maybe impossible.
And from there, things really unravel.
They do. The original Ofglin disappears. Offred finds out later she killed herself to avoid torture. Then Serena Joy finds out about Offred and the commander.
The confrontation.
Pure cold fury. Offred thinks it's the end. Then the black van arrives. The eyes.
Gilead's secret police. Terrifying.
But just as she's being led away, Nick whispers, "It's all right. It's Mayday. Go with them."
Leaving her stepping into, what, darkness or light?
Complete uncertainty, captured in that final line of her narrative. And so I step up into the darkness within, or else the light. Just...
Wow. But Atwood doesn't end it there, does she? There's the epilogue.
The historical notes. Absolutely vital. It's set over 200 years later. An academic conference discussing Offred's story recorded on tapes. As a historical artifact.
So Gilead did fall.
It confirms Gilead fell, yes. But what's unsettling, deeply unsettling, is how Offred's personal trauma becomes this cold academic subject. The professor seems more interested in verifying details than in her suffering.
So what does this all mean for how history gets told? Whose stories survive?
Exactly. It forces you to reevaluate everything. Which leads us to the deeper themes, right? Beyond the plot, what's Atwood really exploring about power, identity, language?
Well, one thing you mentioned earlier is how Gilead uses language itself as a weapon.
Totally. New terms, banning reading for women, changing names.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about stripping identity. But Offred's narration, her internal storytelling, That's her resistance.
It's how she holds onto herself.
Reclaims her identity, preserves memory, asserts her humanity against the silence.
Which ties right into identity and memory as themes. Her memories are her lifeline, aren't they?
Her last private space. It's not just escapism, it's self-preservation. Identity is the story we tell ourselves, and Gilead wants to steal that narrative.
And it also makes you think about complacency, complicity. How does a state like Gilead even happen?
Atwood shows it's not overnight. It's that slow erosion of rights, people looking away. Complacency. Then you see the whole spectrum of resistance, from Moira's defiance to Auckland's plotting to Offred's quiet survival. And underpinning all of that is the novel's powerful feminist critique, the absolute subjugation of women.
Right, reducing them to biological functions.
It's a potent allegory for how patriarchal systems, historically and even now, try to control female autonomy and sexuality.
Linked directly to the dangers of religious extremism.
Definitely. Gilead twists religious doctrine to justify tyranny. It's a huge warning against any ideology claiming absolute moral authority to oppress others.
And of course, reproductive rights, it feels like the absolute center.
It really is. Controlling reproduction is a tool of political and social domination. It makes the novel feel incredibly, disturbingly prescient today, with all the ongoing debates about bodily autonomy.
The way Atwood tells the story is also key, that first-person perspective. It's so intimate, almost claustrophobic.
You are trapped right inside Offred's head, feeling her fear, her fragmented thoughts. And the narration isn't always linear or even reliable. She corrects herself, admits she's guessing.
Which emphasizes how fragile truth is under oppression.
Exactly. And the power of just telling your own story.
And the symbols are everywhere and so potent, like the red of the handmaid's robes.
Symbolizing fertility, blood, danger, but also marking them as state property. Visible objects.
And the eyes. Constant surveillance.
Reading paranoia. Then there's Serena Joy's garden, this symbol of control, desire, fertility, with the flowers like the handmaids themselves. Beautiful, but trapped.
And the white wings they wear?
Blinders, really.
Right.
Symbolizing a false purity, enforced ignorance, cutting them off from the world and each other.
Yeah, and the literary craft is just stunning. The irony is everywhere. Serena Joy's name, for instance.
Given how bitter and cruel she is.
Right, and the name Gilead itself, meaning a place of healing in the Bible for this incredibly sick society, and the hypocrisy of the commanders.
Indulging in everything they deny others. Blatant hypocrisy. Atwood also uses such vivid, visceral imagery. She contrasts the bleakness of Gilead with the richness of Offred's memories.
You really feel what's been lost.
You do. And there's subtle foreshadowing, two hints of the wall, the resistance building this creeping tension. Her prose style itself is remarkable, shifting between lyrical beauty and stark realism. It mirrors Offred's own mind.
Let's talk about some specific quotes that really stand out. The first one has become iconic. Nolite bastards caberundorum.
Oh, yes. Found scratched in the closet.
That mock Latin phrase, roughly, don't let the bastards grind you down. It's more than just graffiti, isn't it?
Oh, much more.
Yeah.
It's this secret message passed down, a symbol of hidden resistance, solidarity. It becomes Offred's private mantra, a tiny defiant whisper.
And then there's that line reflecting on the past. We thought we had such problems. How are we to know we were happy?
Ooh. Yeah, that one hits hard. It captures that theme of taking freedom for granted perfectly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How perspective shifts everything. You only know what you had when it's gone. Exactly. Then there's the commander's chilling line. Better never means better for everyone. It always means worse for some.
That's a cold truth about power.
It really exposes the zero-sum game of oppression. How political promises of a better world often just mask exploitation. It makes you ask, better for whom? And who pays the price?
Definitely. Another powerful one is, ignoring isn't the same as ignorance. You have to work at it.
That speaks volumes about complicity, doesn't it? The idea that people often actively choose willful blindness rather than being truly unaware, looking away becomes a conscious act.
Making everyone somewhat responsible.
In a way, yes. And finally, that metaphor. Nothing changes instantaneously. In a gradually heating bathtub, you'd be boiled to death before you knew it.
A terrifying image for how authoritarianism creeps in.
A stark warning against complacency. It shows how it happens incrementally, through small compromises, until it's too late. It makes the rise of Gilead feel frighteningly plausible. And the overall emotional impact of the book is just profound. You feel Offred suffering so viscerally, it makes oppression feel immediate, personal.
You connect with the loss, the fear, the uncertainty.
Deeply. And that haunting, prophetic quality.
Yeah.
It forces you to look at our own world differently, doesn't it?
It really does. You see echoes, you question things, the fragility of democracy, the erosion of rights.
And it challenges you, the reader. It makes you examine your own capacity for resistance or complicity. There are no easy answers.
No easy moral clarity, which is part of why it stays with you. And that ambiguous ending.
Denies easy closure, definitely.
Yeah.
It leaves you with that mix of hope and anxiety, which feels very true to uncertain times.
And so relevant right now with debates about media, political language, misinformation, how language itself can be a weapon. It demands vigilance.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into The Handmaid's Tale, I think it powerfully reminds us that freedom, well, it's a fragile thing.
It needs constant vigilance, doesn't it? And that even a single quiet voice holds incredible power against the loudest oppressions.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.